accused of something, but I have never hidden any of my assets.
Mr. Prime Minister, what can you tell me about a company called Vintris?
Well, it's a company, if I recall correctly, which is associated with one of the companies that I was on a board of. So now I'm starting to feel a bit strange about these questions, because it's like you are accusing me of something.
So what do you think? Guilty? Not guilty? You be the judge. But in case you don't understand the gravity of the situation, the following clip may jolt you in seeing what tax evasion is all about.
The reality is not what you believe, that your prime minister has the power to decide on the future of your country. The power is hidden here.
So when the UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, comes out and says the UK is committed to a global minimum corporate tax of at least 15%, rallying behind a US-backed plan, it should be taken with a grain of salt.
What this deal does is ensure that with a minimum rate of tax that we can make sure there's a level playing field for countries and companies wherever they're operating, ensuring that they pay the right tax in the right places at the right time.
Please write to us and let us know what you think about the program. Any questions and comments are welcome. The following are our links and addresses. From me, Mahdi, it's goodbye until next week.
Tax evasion, which is different than tax avoidance, we need to make sure that that is clear to you. It's going to persist. Why? Because the law allows it to do so. It's as simple as that. But what is the downside of this? Well, it's how the rich and the corporations, how they're getting away with it and becoming richer as a result. Now, they're doing that at the expense of their citizens. Money that they're avoiding, well, it can go for things like infrastructure, for schools, for hospitals, and things of that nature in general. And in this age of COVID-19, where every penny counts, tax evaders need to be stopped. Of course, that's a huge challenge. Well, that does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you on board, and we do look forward to any comments or questions that you may have. For now, it's goodbye from me, Kavit Tafwai. I'm looking forward to seeing you next time.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The White House is being cagey, but despite withdrawal, the military has been operating nonstop on the ground for 20 years, says Nick Turse, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Washington is not telling the truth about U.S. troops in Somalia. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. There are other parts of the world, including Somalia, Libya, Yemen, where we don't have a presence on the ground, said White House spokesperson Jen Psaki late this summer. That was patently false, but it fits a pattern. The U.S. first dispatched commandos to Somalia shortly after 9/11 and has been conducting airstrikes in the country since 2007. Journalists and human rights organizations have documented scores of civilian victims of these attacks. In 254 declared U.S. actions in Somalia, the UK-based airstrike monitoring group, Air Wars, for example, estimates that as many as 143 civilians have been killed. U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, puts the number at 5. Over the years, America has regularly stationed hundreds of troops in Somalia, including commandos involved in the so-called 127E programs named for a budgetary authority that allows U.S. Special Operations Forces to use local military units as surrogates in counterterrorism missions. These efforts have been conducted under the code names Exile Hunter, Kodiak Hunter, Mongoose Hunter, Paladin Hunter, and Ultimate Hunter, and involved U.S. commandos training and equipping troops from Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, and Uganda as part of the fight against Daesh. The U.S. also maintained no fewer than 5 bases in Somalia as recently as last year. An 11th-hour withdrawal of U.S. forces by the Trump administration was officially completed in mid-January. Under the Biden administration, however, troops soon began commuting to Somalia and an American footprint was reestablished, according to AFRICOM spokesperson John Manley. When asked to explain why Psaki claimed there was no U.S. presence in Somalia, Biden administration officials would only speak off the record. You're welcome to say that the White House declined to give further comments and pointed you to previous interviews where senior officials explained that we do not currently have a large permanent presence on the ground in places like Libya and Somalia, a spokesperson who refused to be named wrote in an email. What constitutes a large permanent presence is unclear, but U.S. troops do indeed have a presence on the ground in Somalia. Our footprint in Somalia is under 100 personnel, though, as you know, that number can fluctuate with periodic engagements, Manley told responsible statecraft. Despite this, Special Operations Command Africa, a Theater Special Operations Command, TSOC, which oversees commandos on the continent and is under operational control of AFRICOM, recently seemed to echo Psaki. When asked for a list of countries where U.S. commandos were deployed in 2021, U.S. Special Operations Command Africa failed to mention Somalia. Asked why Somalia was absent from So, Shafrica, Inventory of Countries, Special Operations Command spokesperson Ken McGraw explained, the TSOCs and the Geographic Combatant Commands they support decide what countries will be on the list they send me. Despite Saki's assertions, South Africa's creative accounting and the supposed withdrawal from Somalia in January, U.S. troops have been operating in Somalia without pause for years on end. Even after the withdrawal earlier this year, Africa spokesperson Colonel Christopher Carnes admitted that U.S. troops, albeit a very limited number, remained. His commander-in-chief, Joe Biden, said the same in a June letter to congressional leaders, writing that only the majority of the United States forces in Somalia redeployed or repositioned to neighboring countries prior to my inauguration as president, unquote.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise again. On Friday, Moscow said it detected six NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea over the span of 24 hours, reiterating its warning that it will defend itself against any threats along its borders. The Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which was reunited with Russia from Ukraine in a referendum in 2014, a move that the West deemed illegal.
2014 was a defining moment. Russia stood up for itself like it stood up in 2015 in Damascus across Syria. And this is what's of most concern to Washington in their search for a unipolar world, that Russia would have the audacity, the courage to stand up for itself.
NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region, in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described on Friday as provocative the increasing NATO's activities in the Black Sea and the presence of Western spy planes in the region.
I mean, Russia doesn't have anywhere close to the amount of U.S. military, the bases that the U.S. has surrounding Russia. Imagine if Russia had bases in Mexico and Canada and in the Pacific. The U.S. would never stand for that. So what we see on full display here is U.S. hypocrisy in the same Russophobic attitude that has characterized U.S. foreign policy for how many decades now.
The Russian Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that the United States was setting up a multinational group of armed forces close to Russia's border in the Black Sea region. The Kremlin has dismissed a Western media report that said the U.S. was concerned about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, noting that Russia has posed no threats to any country.
And of course, the U.S. acting through NATO with its junior allies, constantly building up troops in Latvia, in Estonia, in Poland, across Russia's borders. So it's the Russians that have every right to be concerned.
In the meantime, the migrant crisis at the border between Belarus and Poland is also spiraling into another regional dispute involving the West at Russia's doorsteps. Thousands of migrants have been stranded along the border for months after being denied entry to the European Union by Poland. Minsk says Warsaw is violating international asylum norms by preventing the migrants from crossing the border and greeting them with a heavy-handed response. In face of escalating military activities near the border, Belarus and Russia held snap joint military drills in the area. Russia's defense ministry confirmed in a statement that its paratroopers were taking part in the exercise. Minsk has also threatened to cut off Russian gas supplies to Europe through pipelines that transit through Belarusian territory in retaliation for any possible sanctions from the EU. It would be bad news for Europe if Belarus moves to carry out the threat, as gas prices on the continent have already hit all-time highs and are vulnerable to any possible supply disruption.
The United States has decided to bolster its military ties to NATO ally Greece. The military agreement was concluded during the recent visit of the Greek Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nikos Dendias, to Washington. The new agreement will remain in force indefinitely unless one of the parties withdraws. The military agreement will make Greece the U.S. military logistics center in the region.
Greece has been in America's orbit and has enjoyed a strategic partnership with America ever since the end of the Greek Civil War, in which the Greek nationalists triumphed over the Greek communists as a result of the military assistance which America provided to them.
The U.S. will also have increased military presence in the Alexandroupolis, Crete, the Tochoro, and Larissa regions. The renewed agreement gives the U.S. the right to access any Greek military bases and to expand the areas for the U.S. forces to conduct military drills. The U.S. Navy will also be able to go to Bulgaria and Romania without using Turkey's straits. The agreement will significantly reduce the importance of Turkey regarding Black Sea access. Greece has been trying to position itself strategically in the region.
The Americans are encountering some problems with Erdogan. So by America and Greece concluding this extraordinary military deal, it is a way of the Americans placing subtle pressure on Erdogan, not on the Turkish state, but on Erdogan personally.
In recent months, the U.S. has sent heavy military equipment to the Balkans and European countries through the port of Alexandroupolis, with plans for further military shipments in November. Back in November 2020, Greece submitted a request to the U.S. Department of Defense to purchase F-35 fighter jets. The proposal was welcomed by the U.S. In other words, it would not be surprising if the F-35s, which were not given to Turkey, were given to the neighboring countries soon. The military cooperation between the U.S. and Greece comes amid a row between Ankara and Athens. Greece and Turkey are both NATO members, but they are at loggerheads over a number of issues. Back in 2020, Turkey dispatched Oryx Reis and warships escorting it to survey an area between Cyprus and the Greek island of Crete in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. The mission was meant to explore oil and natural gas in that region. That led to an escalation of tensions, with the two NATO allies launching air and naval drills of their own in the waters.
The major reason behind this agreement, this military agreement between Washington and Athens, is a result of America having gathered some of its allies from the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Middle East in an Eastern Mediterranean partnership. Now, what am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to the reserves of oil and gas which have been found adjacent to Cyprus.
Greece has also accused Turkey of acting like a pirate state in the Aegean Sea in regards to migrants. Athens has called on the EU to put pressure on Ankara to meet its international obligations. Athens frequently blames Ankara for failing to crack down on smugglers who send out migrants in unsafe boats from its shores in breach of a 2016 accord with the European Union. Under the accord, Turkey was to reduce the flow of migrants through its territory to EU countries such as Greece, return for billions in financial aid.
Well, of course, Turkey is a dangerously expansionist country. After all, Turkey illegally occupies the north of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies the northwest of Syria. However, there is very little chance of a conflict between Turkey and Greece. Why? Because both countries are in NATO and both countries enjoy a strategic partnership with America.
It is believed Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is using the migrant issue to put more pressure on the European Union. The military cooperation between Greece and the U.S. would give Athens a greater leverage in its confrontation with Turkey. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not made it a secret in the aspirations that it has to have influence in the entire West Asia region and beyond.
World temperatures are rising fast, and that is mostly because humans are using fossil fuels like oil, gas, and coal for their transportation, industries, and homes. The use of these fuels releases a great amount of greenhouse gases, mostly carbon dioxide, which trap the sun's heat and make the earth warmer. That is global warming. This phenomenon is leading to long-term shifts in temperatures and weather patterns, which is known as climate change. The dangerous trend is causing extreme weather conditions. The impact is being felt in many parts of the world, but the worst could be yet to come. Combating climate change requires concrete measures by the international community, especially the world's largest polluters like the United States and China. But scientists have repeatedly warned that global efforts to tackle climate change are way off track. Global warming and climate change have been under the spotlight in the Scottish city of Glasgow over the past 2 weeks as delegations from around the world attended the UN Climate Change Conference. Participants tried hard to find a way forward to contain what many scientists have called the biggest crisis of humanity. The world's largest industrial nations long struggled to find common ground, but an unexpected declaration by the United States and China this week raised hopes for a breakthrough.
Certain elements that will promote ambition.
The United States and China have pledged to work together to achieve the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal set out in 2015. China's climate envoys, as the two sides hammered out the declaration following some 30 meetings over the past year. U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping are expected to hold a follow-up meeting soon. The announcement was welcomed by the United Nations and the European Union. But global campaigning network Greenpeace says both countries need to take concrete action. Some experts have noted that this week's declaration was short on commitments that would significantly reduce the emissions of harmful gases like CO2.
Everyone is being very careful not to say anything definitive. There are few dates, few specific levels things will get to, and few amounts of money that will go to developing countries. So there's pretty much nothing that doesn't need to be more specific. You know, we're all good guys and we're going to cooperate and make this work. Well, we've heard that before.
Scientists warn that the world faces a race against time. Climate Action Tracker Group has calculated that the world is facing 2.4 degrees of warming by the end of the 21st century. If the world fails to act, scientists estimate that it could even exceed 4 degrees in the future. That will probably lead to destructive heat waves, with many millions of people around the world losing their homes as sea levels rise. Temperature rises must be contained quickly if the international community is determined to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. That means global warming needs to be kept at 1.5 degrees Celsius in the coming decades. That seems like a far-fetched wish, given the record of the worst polluters.
I'm not feeling overly optimistic. I'm not really feeling optimistic at all, because it seems like this is just more grandstanding by the particularly China and the United States and even the European Union, who have gotten things, the developing countries have gotten things to this point.
All eyes are now on the world's largest emitters to see how they will act.
The United States Federal Bureau of Investigation is taken to court over a lawsuit by three Muslim men that alleges the agency illegally conducted surveillance on them on the basis of their religion. Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, Ali Malik, and Yasser Abdulrahim, the three plaintiffs in the case, argue that the U.S. government has for years invoked national security to escape accountability over its unconstitutional surveillance operations and deny them the chance to present their evidence to the court. Initially filed in 2011, their case was first dismissed by a lower court in favor of the FBI's assertion that allowing it to move forward would pose a national security risk. The trio appealed the ruling, and a federal appeals court later sided with them, paving the way for the case to land in the High Court. The FBI recruited a paid informant to spy on the mosque and other places of worship in the area beginning in 2006. The informant, identified as Craig Monte, had presented himself as a person who wanted to convert to Islam.
They've always tried to label Muslims as potential terrorists and investigate them, monitor them, looking in, you know, all their most of their privacy has been breached. All these mosques, as we can read and study about, is pretty much, you know, it's open to the FBI to, you know, send in informants, spies, make them feel very uncomfortable, and also a lot of them are saying that they feel like second-class citizens or third-class citizens inside their own country.
Fazaga, the lead plaintiff in the case who is also a therapist, said he was furious when he found out that the FBI informant secretly recorded the personal and confidential sessions he had with his patients for a month. The surveillance operation in Southern California was part of a broader spying program that the U.S. government enforced after 9/11, using various tactics to monitor Muslim communities in the name of national security.
This is a systematic problem, and they wanted it to be this way. It's been programmed like this by the U.S. It's because they want to install fear in the American citizens everywhere, so they can also justify invasions to Muslim countries and to, invade different Muslim countries.
The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling on the Muslims case by the end of June. Lawyers for the government will argue that the case should be dismissed, as letting it proceed would expose clandestine intelligence operations and harm national security. The FBI has long contended that the information about its informants, methods of surveillance, and who they are monitoring and why should be treated as state secrets. Human rights activists, however, say citing national security concerns is an excuse to avoid admitting that they target people based on their religion. The plaintiffs argue that under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, a judge can review the material and order that it be disclosed. They contend that in a case like theirs, the 1978 law supersedes the state secrets privilege, which was adopted by the Supreme Court in the 1950s. Government lawyers' counter-argument is that FISA was not meant for a case where the government certifies that the disclosure would jeopardize national security. All eyes are on the Supreme Court justices, whose ruling will indicate whether they are willing to protect religious freedoms or if the government has the authority to cover up its illegal activities in the name of national security.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. God, oh, I'm late. I might miss the flight. The traffic was very heavy. My ticket. Where is my ticket? Oh, I found it. Here it is. Oh. Find the check-in gate for my flight. I'm going to take a trip to Desful, and after that, I'm going to visit the city of Shush. Today, I'm going to visit Shush Museum. Shush, or Susa, is a city located in Khuzestan province in southwestern Iran. Shush is one of the most ancient cities in the world. This city is 24 kilometers away from Desful. The ancient city of Shush is the capital of thousands-year-old Elamite civilization. This city has also been the winter capital of Achaemenid Empire. Shush Museum has some of the important treasures that have been discovered during the excavations of this city. Shush Museum is located near Akropol Hill, which is one of the most important archaeological sites of the world. Many of the objects that were discovered during the excavations of this hill are now kept in Shush Museum. This museum is located near Shush Castle, which is known as the French Castle, because it used to be inhabited by French archaeologists for a while. Shush Museum has six halls, four big halls, and two small halls. The four big halls of Shush Museum keep the relics of Elamite, Achaemenid, Parthian, and Sasanid eras. Oh, I finally reached the beautiful city of Shush. Now I'm waiting for a taxi which is going to take me to Shush Museum. To be honest, I'm really excited because I don't know what unique things I'm going to see at Shush Museum. And now I am in the big garden of Shush Museum. The building of the museum is a beautiful brick-made structure and is located in the middle of the garden. The walls around the garden are short, yet the trees in here are tall. They're taller than the walls. Here, there are pomegranate trees, palm trees, eucalyptus trees, and jujube. Some of the statues or archaeological relics are kept in glass showcases. Their characteristics are written on a metal plate. Oh, look at here. Here is a big stone statue of an animal which has its tail stuck to its body. I don't know what kind of animal it is. It's amazing anyway. And a few meters away, there are the columns of Apadana Palace. I am now inside the museum. Just in front of me, there is the statue of Hercules. It's Hercules standing calm, squeezing a lion's neck with his hands. What a wonderful statue! It belongs to the Parthian era. Here, there is the statue of a winged horse. This horse has been discovered from the Apadana Palace, yes. Oh well, this museum is full of unique things which have no pair anywhere in the world. Some of them include Elamite and Parthian head sculptures, stone inscriptions with Sumerian alphabets, sculptures of animals' heads, so many wares and decorative objects and armbands, etc. Well, describing these ancient objects needs time, and I suggest you to travel to the city of Shush and visit this great museum.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
10 innocent family members were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to its promises as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajmal's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them. And the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pervasive challenges remain for migrants and asylum seekers no matter Europe, the United States, or Asia. The recent immigrant crisis on the Belarusian border with Poland has refreshed the plight refugees have endured at the hands of some governments. Thousands of asylum seekers are currently stranded in desperate conditions on the Belarusian border, with thousands of Polish soldiers, guards, and police on the other side blocking their entry. Ironically, the European Union has backed Poland's move in line with the bloc's resolve that it will go to any length to prevent migrants from reaching its external borders. This means turning a blind eye to even gross human rights abuses against refugees. Instead of searching for a mechanism to resolve the crisis, the EU has rather opened a diplomatic war with Belarus and Russia by directly pointing its finger at the two for the current problem. The 27-member bloc is not an exception. Just recently, the United States violently encountered with mostly Haitian immigrants near its borders. Hundreds were deported and thousands were sent to detention centers. It seems the Biden administration has continued the footsteps of its predecessor that took a tough stance on asylum seekers. An estimated 70,000 people destined for the U.S. have encountered with similar fates over the past 4 years. The brutal family separation was the darkest part of the Trump era, as authorities are still unable to track down parents of hundreds of kids. The treatment of immigrants by the U.S. highlights its double standards on human rights. The issue Washington often uses as a pretext to impose sanctions on others. But the real question is, what is the root cause of the migrant crisis? Isn't the West, especially the United States, the main culprit for its wars and the subsequent influx of refugees in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a live example that was left in a mess by the U.S. and its allies after almost 2 decades of military presence. People had no choice but to flee the country after the Taliban takeover in mid-August. The number of immigrants has even increased in neighboring Iran, with over 5,000 Afghans reportedly entering the country on a daily basis. The UN has praised Iran, but the sanctions-hit country hasn't received some $136 million in funding the world body said the Islamic Republic needed to support the refugees.
Tens of thousands of workers belonging to South Korea's largest umbrella labor union rallied on the streets of downtown Seoul, defying a city government ban on their gathering.
The current infringement of basic rights by the government under the name of coronavirus prevention is a blindly criminal act which destroys the Constitution.
At the rally location in 1970, 22-year-old Chun Tae-il burned himself to death to protest against the terrible working conditions he endured. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit those in the service sector particularly hard, with layoffs and reductions in hours.
This year especially, many casual workers have suffered because of the coronavirus. They've lost their jobs and had their income reduced due to unpaid leave. We are holding this rally to stop this irrationality.
Demonstrators also protested the gap between regular and irregular workers and a growing disparity between haves and have-nots. South Korean truckers and railway workers have been threatening walkouts recently, with Hyundai union workers voting to strike Friday. South Koreans will be heading to the polls in about 5 months to elect a new president of the country. The main candidates have been decided. And now political forces, like the unionists here today, have begun to battle to see their interests top the campaign agenda. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a fresh air strike carried out by Saudi warplanes against Yemenis, 4 civilians, including 3 children, were killed. 2 others were also wounded in the strike in Tuhaita district in the Hodeidah province. Officials say the attack is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement that prohibited airstrikes on the coastal province.
There are many violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition, whether through airstrikes or direct attacks on civilians by the mercenaries in Tuhaita and other areas. The Stockholm Agreement prohibited any military action in the Hodeidah Governorate, but unfortunately, the violations of this unbrokered agreement did not stop.
Observers say the international community's inaction towards the continuous Saudi attacks on Yemeni civilians, especially the silence of the UN Security Council, is yet another proof of how Riyadh is bribing its way through the world body.
Through our long experience with the United Nations, it's clear that Saudi and Emirati money plays the most prominent role in determining the decisions of the world body, including the Security Council, the Secretary General, and the UN envoy. There is a clear bias regarding the Saudi-led coalition.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces took control of several districts in the coastal province of Hodeidah, including the international road linking Sana'a with Hodeidah, after a sudden withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces.
Regardless of the catastrophic situation in Yemen, which the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the Saudi violations against millions of Yemenis. People here believe the inaction emboldens Saudi Arabia to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a 2-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. The Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreement. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is a UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment and custodial torture continue with impunity while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem in Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over 7 decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Islamic Jihad movement held a massive festival in the Gaza Strip marking the second anniversary of the assassination of Baha Abul Atta, Islamic Jihad commander, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes on his house. Targeting Abul Atta triggered a tough round of violence between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We are here to express our support to the resistance front that has never failed to defend us. Palestinians in Gaza are living in a continuous struggle, but this makes us more determined to defend our rights.
Baha Abul Atta was the head of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. Baha was one of the most prominent members of its military wing and played a major role in carrying out operations against Israel.
We will remain steadfast and committed to our oath to our leader, Baha Abul Atta. Losing our commanders won't undermine our resistance. We will resist and won't be hesitant to defend our people and the Palestinian cause.
Palestinians in this event also stressed following in the footsteps of Abu al-Ata in the battle against the Israeli occupation, vowing to keep their resistance until their rights are restored.
Our message to the Israeli regime is that if you assassinate a leader, there will be thousands of other leaders to continue the path of resistance. The killing of Palestinian leaders won't undermine our will to keep up our fight against Israel.
Palestinians here say that the killing of the leaders won't stop the battle against the Zionists. They also vow to remain committed to their resistance as their only means to defend their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
New Delhi hosted a third regional summit to discuss the ongoing situation in neighboring Afghanistan following the recent pullout of U.S. and NATO forces from the country. The conference was chaired by India's National Security Advisor Ajit Doval and his counterparts from other Central Asian nations. India's National Security Advisor opened the dialogue.
We all have been keenly watching the developments in that country. These have important implications not only for the people of Afghanistan but also for its neighbors and the region. This is the time for close consultations amongst us, greater cooperation and interaction and coordination among the regional countries.
Top security officials reiterated pledge to work for ensuring safe Afghanistan and what they called free of safe haven for global terrorism. The delegates also called for formation of inclusive government in Kabul, stressing the territory should not be used for sheltering, training, planning or financing terror activities.
This could perhaps be the first time Central Asian countries are coming together on a single platform to not only discuss their role in rebuilding war-ravaged Afghanistan, but also formulate a collective strategies which could promote peace, stability and security in the region.
Issues related to radicalization, extremism, separatism and drug trafficking in the region were also discussed in the meeting. The officials expressed deep concern about the sufferings Afghan people have endured before and after the U.S. fallout. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, stressed on rebuilding inclusive Afghanistan, saying U.S. policies brought nothing but miseries and devastation in the region.
Afghanistan's neighbors need to fulfill its duties to settle the crisis unfolding in the country, including efforts to hold to account the countries behind the current situation there, establish an inclusive government comprised of all ethnicities there, and tackle the humanitarian crisis gripping the war-torn country. The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to rebuild Afghanistan. Regional partners should also exert pressure on the United States to unblock the financial resources of the oppressed nation.
Security chiefs from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan also attended the talks. However, neighboring China and Pakistan did not attend the forum, citing scheduling reasons. The first two editions of the event were held in Iran in September 2018 and December 2019. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Leaving amid shouts of shame, Israel's UK ambassador, Zippy Hotobly, escorted flower in hand by her security detail to her car as British police ward off peaceful pro-Palestine protesters earlier this week. Hotobly, a fervent opponent of Palestinian statehood, had been controversially invited by the London School of Economics Student Union to a debate on Middle East peace.
As she emerged from the debate, she was met with students and pro-Palestine activists exercising their democratic right to protest. But there was a problem with that. It was a peaceful protest against the ambassador of one of Britain's closest allies with powerful pressure groups in British politics.
That has meant a torrent of criticism and condemnation from the pro-Israel media and government ministers. From the British Foreign Secretary, who has called the protest unacceptable, to the Home Secretary, who has described it as disgusting and anti-Semitic.
What is the evidence for this? People...